Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon. We are going to talk about a topic that is fresh on our minds because the new issue of Sunstone is out, and it's called Earth Stewardship. I've also received a really good suggestion that we do this topic from one of our listeners, Dave Dixon, so I wanted to make sure to give him a shout-out here. My own history with Mormonism and environmentalism goes quite long. I've written for Irrantum and their environmental issue. I did my dissertation on resources within Mormonism for environmental spirituality, sort of sustainable world stuff. So I love this topic. I can't even believe that I didn't do it before. So I'm thrilled to be doing it, and we've got wonderful, wonderful guests. George Handley was with us last year when we talked about theologies of nature, and it was sort of in the wake of the earth quakes and whether God's involved with natural disasters and things like that. And there he just spoke so wonderfully and broadly about deeper environmental stuff that we just had to have him on. So he was my first call for this podcast. George, would you mind reintroducing everybody to just the basics of what you do for a living and maybe your book and stuff like that?
Sure. Thanks, Dan, for having me. I teach at BYU. I've been here since 1998 and I've been reading and teaching and writing about the intersection between literature, religion, and the environment for most of the time I've been at BYU, and especially, of course, with a special interest in the intersection with Mormonism and the environment and environmental ethics. I co-hosted a symposium at BYU in 2004 on the environment that led to a collection of essays that we published called Stewardship and the Creation. And then I just recently published a memoir called Home Waters, A Year of Recompenses on the Provo River, which looks at family history, environmental history of the Provo River, and environmental theology and things of that sort. And we're also hosting a new symposium at BYU in November on stewardship, broadly defined, and questions of sustainability and ecological restoration, which should be a lot of fun.
Wow, I hadn't heard about that. That's great.
I'm married. I have four children and live in Provo.
Super. Appreciate that. It's great to have you back, and we'll be asking you all sorts of questions to go deep with. Rachel Whipple is our next guest. I was excited to read her essay in Sunstone. I had never really connected Rachel's name with anything before, but I came to learn after talking with her that she's been quite active in these conversations for a while. Rachel, would you sort of let people know what you do and what your essay in Sunstone was about?
Hi. Well, I am not an expert scholar like George is, but I'm a housewife. And so the work that I do on the environmental front is all done on the home front. And because I've always cared, I try to live my life in accordance with my beliefs. So I do things like hanging my laundry on the line and baking bread and sewing clothes and, you know, repairing things. And the whole idea is that I take care of what I have and try to repair and restore and renew instead of just throwing things away and buying new things.
One of the things that will maybe be a big gasp and gulp that you do seem to avoid as a person with several children is you use cloth diapers.
I did. Thankfully, I don't have to anymore. My youngest is almost five.
But that's probably one of the biggest stumbling blocks out there, I bet, when people go, what?
Yeah, I didn't have a lot of support in the Mormon community, but you know, I was able to find an environmental community that supported me in that. But as wife to a grad student where we had no money. We didn't even have a washer and dryer. I had to wash these things by hand when my first two were little. It just made me feel, I don't know, more self-sufficient. I didn't have to go to the store to buy diapers because I could just wash them.
Really cool. Thanks for being on, and we'll mine the depths of your practices and the sensibilities behind them. So thank you. Craig Galley is our third guest. Craig and I just barely got to know each other when I chatted with him a day or two ago. He was suggested to me through Dave Dixon, and I had a chance to see a PowerPoint that he has listed online, and we're really excited to have Craig. Would you mind introducing yourself to everybody?
Happy to do that. I'm an attorney in Salt Lake City. I have four daughters and three grandsons and a granddaughter in the process who will come out in September. We are trying to teach all of our children and grandchildren to love the outdoors and fly fish. And I teach environmental law part-time. I've done it at the University of Utah and at BYU Law School.
Cool. So is your entire practice devoted to environmental law?
Yes.
Very cool. Very cool. Like, what types of things are going on right now? I'm curious.
Well, I'm in a large law firm, so most of my clientele will be industry. I do a lot of work for energy companies, but many of them try to have corporate sustainability programs and have very stringent environmental compliance programs, which I often help them with. And I've been involved in a whole host of environmental litigation in Utah and throughout the West.
Good. Well, we'll be excited, and please bring all that background with you as we respond to various things. Well, if you guys are ready, let's just dive in, and let me just ask the question this way, and maybe I'll just have you take the question in the order of which you introduced yourselves. When somebody comes up to you, you know, either within on a sacrament meeting or something, that kind of heard that you're environmentally sensitive, or just somebody from the outside world says, where is Mormonism today, would you say, on the environmental scale? Are we ahead of the curve, behind the curve? Is it a big deal? Where do you sense things are right now regarding Mormonism and the environment?
Well, there are a lot of ways to answer that. I try to give the most optimistic answer, usually, just because I find cynicism an unhelpful state of mind to be in, and I try to keep myself out of it as much as possible, and don't enjoy dragging others into it when I find myself stuck. So, but I think Mormonism, the Mormon Church, Mormon culture, Mormon politics, there are a lot of different angles there. I would say we are, as a church, it's a very mixed record. As a church and a culture, it's a very mixed record. I mean, I think things are improving all the time in both in terms of institutional practices and in the culture, but we still have a long ways to go. And so I would say we have that mixed record. On some issues, we are extraordinarily ahead of the curve, sometimes almost without knowing it. You know, something simple like keeping the Sabbath day holy, for a lot of other religious communities, that's become a very vital component to fighting climate change, for example. A lot of people are arguing and urging their fellow members of different religions to be more serious about not working on Sunday, not recreating on Sunday, because that will reduce consumption. And we do that almost, again, without realizing the environmental benefits of it, but we're certainly very good at it. And we're very good at, some of us anyway, I think, are very good at sort of resourceful living and making good use of things. And the church is doing great things with green architecture. In fact, very much ahead of the curve in some ways with things that are happening most recently in terms of green design of chapels and major church structures. So I think there are a lot of signs that things are moving in the right direction. And I think the link that maybe once existed in people's minds, and I want to emphasize that I think it was more in people's minds than it ever was in reality, between Mormonism and anti-environmentalism, I think that's really starting to separate, and that's, you know, anti-environmentalism still exists, but it's not as easy as maybe it was 15 or 20 years ago to make an overt argument that Mormonism sort of obligates one to be right. against the environment or environmentalism. I think that's a pretty hard argument to make these days.
Terrific. And we'll loop back to you if you have some more. Rachel, that gives me a nice little opening to something you said in your essay. Maybe I can have you start your section on this. And that would be, you say that you have purposely avoided using the word environmentalist because perhaps a little bit of the echo of what George was talking about, and you choose something else instead.
Yeah, I found that some Mormons are suspicious of environmentalism. Environmentalism has, you know, kind of taken on its own movement. Some people view it as almost a false religion, you know, or that it's just a political thing. And because they have these connotations with it, they reject anything that they think has to do with environmentalism. But if we look at it in terms of stewardship, which really is the same thing, then it's more approachable to an LDS audience.
Good, good. Yeah. Keep going.
Well, I was thinking about your question. Within the Mormon community, I don't hear a lot of talk about environmentalism, but any time that I've been in a ward or a branch, I've ended up teaching environmentally sustainable type things. Like, I've taught classes on recycling and worm composting and container gardening and actually all kinds of gardening, even though I'm not the best gardener in the world. But just being willing to teach, I think, you know, makes you qualified sometimes in LDS circles. And people are really receptive to those things, so long as they're presented in terms of stewardship or as practical ways of living the gospel and managing households.
Terrific. We'll just loop back to you too. Craig, what do you say when a colleague from perhaps outside of Mormon land comes to you and says, what about your church and this lack of greenness, or whatever they might say?
Well, I agree with George that it's pretty easy to point to some of the great things that the church has done recently with some of their commercial real estate projects. City Creek Center is an example. We have prototype stake centers being constructed with solar panels. We're increasing the use of recycling church-wide. The church and its management of its agricultural properties and ranches has increasingly been recognized as a leader for habitat protection and enhancement. There are a lot of things that you can point to, but what I like to point to is the richness of our theology. While it may not take on the prominence that some things do, like the word of wisdom and the law of chastity, it's very easy to find quotes dating all the way back to Joseph Smith, and including scriptures and the Pearl of Great Price and the Doctrine and Covenants that underscore the sacred nature of the earth and our responsibility for it. And I would argue, from a comparative religious standpoint, we must have one of the more rich eco-theologies of any organized religion.
Yeah, I agree, yeah. And we're going to go into that. That's really the whole podcast right there, where you're heading us there. So definitely, you can go ahead and keep hinting at it right now, but we're going to totally dive in next on that.
Okay, well, go ahead.
Okay. Before we left this, though, I wanted to ask a little bit, because of this eco-theology that Craig is talking about here, I think all of us feel fairly optimistic because we're aware of it being there. It's endemic to the religion. So it is something you can kind of bring up without, you know, having somebody say, oh, they're just bringing in the radical environmental, you know, message into the church. This really is actually something right there. But how much do you guys think it is theologically or culturally a problem versus the fact that we have such conservative politics within the church? Is it a political reaction that sometimes keeps us from moving ahead?
Well, I mean, if you compare environmental attitudes in the Rocky Mountain West, for example, you find that there are a lot of similarities across the states in the Intermountain West that have nothing to do with Mormonism and have a lot more to do with this region.
Okay.
If you take Mormons from Seattle and Mormons from California or Mormons from the East Coast or international Mormons, I mean, we've been a part of an organization, I think all of us, here and there, called LDS Earth Stewardship, and that group has members from Germany, from Australia, England, and of course different parts of the United States. And so I don't know that there's ever been an exhaustive demographic study of Mormon environmental attitudes to find out where the sore points are, but I'm sure that the Intermountain West has to explain many of the attitudes we find here that I think we should remember are not generally true.
Good.
A colleague of mine at BYU, Chip Oscarson, is a Scandinavian specialist, and he travels to Scandinavia frequently. He's talked to Mormons in Sweden, and they were absolutely perplexed that there was any problem at all about environmental attitudes in the United States among Mormons. So I think it's fair to say that we're probably looking at something that is a function of the history of the states being formed in the Intermountain West, you know, lots of federal land and resentment toward the federal government, and, you know, maybe anti-polygamy issues in the 19th century that exacerbated some of those attitudes, and then you marry that with conservative politics in the Intermountain West, and you end up with pretty vehement, outspoken anti-environmentalists in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and 90s, and hopefully those are dying out. But I think that attitude has been pretty strong in this particular part of the country.
Yeah, terrific. Either of Craig or Rachel, thoughts just quickly on, you know, is it just the political layer that perhaps keeps us back culturally a bit?
Well, it's a deep shift, I think, with when you look at the historic roots of the very conservative movement that George referenced, that can be recognized with an extreme anti-government regulation bent, coupled with the notion that private property rights are absolute, which is not consistent with our American jurisprudence, nor even historically what the founding fathers understood to be property. There were always supposed to be limits to the use of property, but we've experienced, especially since the economic crash in 2008, an increasing shift to the right of some of the anti-government regulatory positions and an absolutist view of the use of private property and free markets. And that probably cannot be explained as a religious phenomenon or a cultural phenomenon, but really can be seen throughout the entire Intermountain West. And it's at its most extreme probably right now, but the pendulum shifts. And I think in the coming years, we'll move back to more of a central, centrist position where we understand the need for the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and these other statutes, which incidentally were largely enacted during the Republican Nixon administration.
Terrific. Rachel, anything on this section?
Yeah, well, I think politics is important. But I think another thing is, at least for American Mormons, is that we've really kind of bought into the American consumerist lifestyle, and it's inherently wasteful because, you know, we're consuming rather than producing. And I think that in that way, it's very apolitical. It's just what we're surrounded by, and we are becoming a less peculiar people and assimilating into society where it's important to buy things and have things and to show how much you earn by how much you spend.
Yes.
And that's, of course, very anti-environmental because it is so wasteful.
Terrific. And boy, I hope everyone, I will link to your article because you really spend a good couple of pages on that right in the very beginning. I love it.
I just want to second what Rachel was saying about the impact or the influence of commercialism. I think that's really a very influential part of our culture, and I think we tend to adopt ideologies or worldviews that accommodate our consumer habits rather than allowing our consumer habits to be guided by our worldview. And our worldview presumably should be shaped by religious values primarily. So sometimes we get it backwards.
Yes, terrific. Thank you. I'm really excited for our audience to be able to dive in and read more about that. Let's move into really where I kind of teased a minute ago, and in our pre-circulation, we kind of said this is where we want to focus. Each of you have a good sense and the different things that you read and talk about for these wonderful resources within Mormonism itself, within our scripture, within our teachings. Craig was mentioning church leaders with wonderful statements all along. These things are right there in Mormonism, and it seems like they just need to be pumped up or given a chance to have a little more light shown upon them. Awesome. And I just would love to just turn you guys loose in this next section for your favorite thing. So when somebody comes up to you and says, why is it what is it about your Mormonism that feeds your environmental sensibilities? What are some things that you jump with first? So Craig, maybe it's your turn just to kind of lead off. What would be some of your favorite two or three things to start with?
Well, with respect to the issue of overconsumption and materialism, I really do think that there is a connection between overconsumption and a misunderstanding of what our obligations are, both ethically as well as even patriotically, and again, what the role of government is. And there's a fascinating quote by Joseph F. Smith, if I might just read a couple lines from it. He says, "The Latter-day Saints ought not to be governed by purely selfish motives in the use of their landed inheritances," in other words, in use of our private property. Quote, "The policy of living for today is not only destructive of our material interests, but it begets a selfishness harmful to religion and discreditable to patriotism." So here we see the notion of the common good being consistent with our religious and our patriotic duties. And I think in this current political climate, we've kind of lost that concept of the common good. And it has a impact on the way we consume. We think that we're just fine using whatever resources we have, and that's our the right that the Lord has given us without consideration for future generations and so forth. And along those lines, probably my favorite quote on this subject comes from President Ezra Taft Benson. He said, quote, "We are morally obligated to turn this land over to those who succeed us, not drained of its fertility, but improved in quality, in productivity, and in usefulness for future generations. I am sure our Heavenly Father expects us to use these precious natural resources wisely, unselfishly, and effectively, both our soil and our water. The Church has urged its members to be efficient users of our resources and to avoid waste and pollution, and to clean up their own immediate environment or that over which they have control." Close quote.
Cool. So, in addition to these just being quotes, that sometimes when you're talking with a fellow Latter-day Saint, they say, well, back it up with some, prophet statement or something like that. You're basically tying this, at least it seems like the theme in at least one of the themes in this is our sort of long view of history and family and multiple generations and passing forward. So is that where you're centered with those two quotes? If you were to sort of say, what's the theme within Mormonism that feeds it?
Yes, I think this theme runs from the very beginnings of Mormonism, from Joseph Smith telling the brethren not to kill rattlesnakes, to Brigham Young telling the brethren not to shoot more bison than they can consume, to a recent quote in conference by Elder Russell and Nelson, quote, as beneficiaries of the divine creation, what shall we do? We should care for the earth, be wise stewards over it, and preserve it for future generations. So the fact that these quotes are not read weekly from the pulpit does not in any way discredit them. It just means that we need to be more vigilant in studying what the prophets have said, what the brethren have said over time, and try to live these teachings.
Yeah, good. And right there, again, not only be great to grab those quotes and stick them on 3x5 cards or whatever in your scriptures or whatever in case it comes up, but it seems like this is a natural opening whenever, you know, thinking about the future generations and linking past and present and all that environmental stuff. It seems like it would be something you could weave right in there. So I'm glad for that good start, and we'll come back to you for more, Craig. George, where do you like to start in terms of a theological principle, a doctrinal idea, or something that really resonates for you as well as you've found it to be effective with others when you talk to them about it?
Well, I would say two things mainly in broad strokes, and one is connected to what Craig's quotes were getting at, and that is the law of consecration and the mandate to be wise stewards over earthly resources. I don't think, and as Craig, I think, rightly said, in a comparative religious context, it's hard to find as many direct statements about stewardship and the importance of being wise users of God's gifts. It's hard to find a religion that has quite so many mandates clearly stated in Scripture as we do. And I think if you look holistically at the law of consecration and the need to distribute resources more equitably, you're looking at a very vital code for environmental sustainability, because environmental problems are essentially problems of distribution of resources. So I think it's a great key to helping solve a lot of environmental problems if we can learn to be more just in our consumption and more mindful of others and of future generations. And the second sort of broad stroke is that Mormonism has an extraordinary emphasis on the body and on the body of this earth, not only our own, you know, individual bodies, but the body of the earth. And this earth is very central to our theology. It's where we're destined to end up if we make it to the celestial kingdom. We believe in an embodied God. And these are really key issues because a lot of traditional Christianity has sometimes struggled with environmental ethics because environmental problems seem to make demands on us here and now that some theologies will put off for a later time or say that are unimportant or secondary to higher aims. And Mormonism, I think, always insists, just, you know, going to Joseph Smith's basic teaching that the spirit and the body constitute the soul of man and that we are capable of greater degrees of happiness and progress as united between spirit and body. We're not a theology that's looking beyond the physical. And I think that's really a powerful thing. I mean, everything from the idea that the earth was created spiritually before it was created physically, the trees are living souls, animals are living souls, all of those doctrines seem to me to point to a very beautiful, integrated set of principles and ethics that give me pause whenever I consider the here and now. I understand the here and now to be part of what I'm building toward in the future rather than something to sort of suffer through or ignore and wade through, but, you know, with my nose plugged, but instead sort of roll up my sleeves and make this world a better place in preparation for what comes.
Very good, very good. Now, you've talked, he kind of gave a litany there for a minute of some things that we could definitely go deeper on, everything from the celestial kingdom, you know, the earth being the celestial kingdom, to animals having spirits, to almost every creation. We sort of have a panpsychism within Mormonism. Do you guys want to go deeper on any of that? I mean, is this something that, Rachel, either you or Craig would do generally push with people when you start to say, you know, Joseph Smith sort of taught that everything has intelligence? And I mean, how much do you guys do with that?
Oh, I talk about it quite a bit.
Okay.
I really love the idea of consecration because, you know, not only do we recognize that everything we have we must be willing to give up to build God's kingdom on the earth. But everything that we have is God's in the first place, and we need to take care of it in the meantime, even before we're called to give it. And I like that with consecration, we have the idea of community, that we're working together to do this.
Okay, but does consecration come to you, or do you think it connects more with people when you say, well, we have these scriptures and we have this teaching and we have this covenant in the temple about consecration. When it comes from the top down, does that work as well as when consecration and stewardship and all the other stuff comes from this bottom-up spirituality, almost this deeper core thing that George was hinting at there, that everything has intelligence and therefore everything has intrinsic value, and therefore there shouldn't be anything that we don't consider it in its own ends, its own desires, you know, when we live. So in other words, it's like, to me, somehow there's consecration as it's taught from the top down as well as from the bottom up. Where do you grab most of your stuff, or where do you think it connects best with Mormons?
Well, I think Mormons feel very comfortable when they are given things through authoritative statements. That makes us feel more confident in the beliefs that we have personally, which may be this more bottom-up kind of thing that you're talking about, but we need to feel justified by statements from general authorities and things like that. So we really need both. But if you're only doing things just because you heard somebody tell you to in a talk, you're going to either do it poorly or feel like you should do it and guilty for not really doing it.
Right.
That's personal motivation in order for anything to really work. Whether it's, you know, being responsible in your personal finances or reading your scriptures or, you know, how well you do your recycling, you've got to be self-motivated there.
Right. So that's good. That's a really good answer. You know, we need them both. And, you know, ultimately, I think you want it to settle as part of just the general sensibility towards life that you has become deep within your character. But yeah, we shouldn't disparage it when it's taught from above, you know, as the initial push or something, perhaps. Craig or George, do either of you make a lot of hay with intrinsic value of all things based upon this doctrine of intelligence, or somehow everything within the universe, you know, is there's this explicit statements that to have joy in the measure of its own creation, that it has its own ends, its own desires, and we should honor those and work with creation rather than exploit creation?
Well, for me personally, yes, it certainly resonates, but I'd like to go back to the top down versus the bottom up.
Cool.
Question that you raised a moment ago. Mm-hmm. You know, interestingly, in our theology, we are also told that it is not meet that the Lord needs to command us in all things. And if we're compelled in all things, we are slothful and unwise, and we don't receive an award, our reward. That's right in D&C 58, verse 26. And Joseph Smith said that he teaches. Correct principles, and they then let the members of the church govern themselves. And I think that's been the mantra for every prophet. Now, today, of course, we live in a time where we have so much information on any environmental issue you can find, regardless of whether how clouded it is with the political milieu. But you can find information on recycling, what the greenest car manufacturers are, clothing manufacturers. There is no end to how much information there is out there on how to be good stewards of the environment. This is not something that needs to be taught from the top of the church hierarchy down. We should be able to understand that with all the scriptures on the need to be good stewards, we need to figure out within our own families what our responsibilities are. And even if we had a top-down approach, I don't know that it would really do any good. We don't have the brethren telling us to floss our teeth or not to drink energy drinks, but anybody who is paying attention and cares about their body and cares about their health is going to figure out that it's probably not a good idea to drink not only energy drinks, but heavily caffeinated drinks or even carbonated drinks. We don't need to be taught this stuff, but those of us who within our families want to treat these topics seriously and study them out in our own minds and learn the correct principles and teach our children, there is an absolute wealth of information. We are so blessed to live in this time where we can cut through the cultural baggage and even the politics and get good information on how to be good stewards of the earth.
Cool. Thanks. I agree. George, either feel free to jump in on where George and Rachel were just talking or go back to the, you know, joy in the measure of their creation or any kind of intelligence, intrinsic value stuff.
Well, I'll comment on that intrinsic value. I don't think we know exactly what our doctrines mean, which I think is part of the fun of them. I mean, I don't say that as a negative. I think it's really interesting that we have these intriguing statements. You know, we have doctrines about intelligence not being created. We don't really know exactly what that means, but or we know that everything, like I say, was created spiritually before it was created physically. What they do mean for me is they certainly give those two doctrines in particular give me a lot of pause. They cause me, and I think that pause is really valuable, and they cause me to reflect on the possibilities of intrinsic value. They seem to point toward a vibrancy and a life force in the world that is good and that is beautiful, and that what I perceive to be as beautiful and or in some cases maybe even awesome and overwhelming and frightening about nature is part of that life force that I have to respect and stand in awe of in to some degree. I mean, when I look at the line in the book of Moses that describes the creation of the trees and says and the passage says, and man could behold it, and man saw that it was good for food. I just love that phrase, and man could behold it. I mean, I think there's something, why that's such an unnecessary phrase to put in there, and yet it's there, and it's the first thing that human beings seem to be doing is looking in awe at the world around them. And of course, we know from section 59 that it pleases God that we find pleasure, aesthetic pleasure, in the beauty and the strangeness. I mean, it's not just beauty in the sense of like a nice landscape or a beautiful sunset, but I think that the strangeness and awesomeness of nature, and maybe even the ways in which nature frightens us, are moments where we can sort of grant to nature its own subjectivity, its own intrinsic value, as you put it. And I think the doctrine of the creation, everything is designed to fulfill the measure of its creation, I think is a wonderful mandate for biodiversity. I mean, that's just how I hear that. I know that we need biodiversity. And as Craig was saying, there's no lack of information on the need for biodiversity and why it's important to life on this planet. And it's always shallow understanding when we hear people mocking that notion. But when you listen to LDS doctrine, it's pointing to the intrinsic right of all living things to reproduce, to multiply and replenish. That's the same mandate. That's the same phrase that God uses to the fowls of the air and to the fishes in the sea. He's not just commanding human beings to multiply and replenish, but he's commanding the fish and he's commanding the fowls to fill the earth. And obviously, I think that it's not just fish and fowl, right?
Right.
It's also porcupines and rattlesnakes and all the rest.
Right.
I think that's beautiful.
Can I just... I think
that means we have to. We're part of this great web of life that we have to learn how to respect.
Very cool. Craig, you want to jump
May
in?
May I just add one? Yes, and George's comment earlier reminded me of one of my favorite basic tenets of Mormon doctrine, and it goes to the pre-existence and our relationship with the earth during our pre-existence our pre-existent state. And again, a quote from Joseph F. Smith on this point, it just kind of gives me goosebumps. Quote, "Our spirits existed before they came to this world. They were in the councils of heaven before the foundations of the earth were laid. We were there. We sang together with the heavenly hosts for joy when the foundations of the earth were laid." In other words, when the earth was created, and when the plan for our existence upon this earth and redemption were mapped out, we were there, we were interested, and we took a part in this great preparation. To think about our witnessing and maybe even participating as pre-existent scriptures in laying the foundations of the earth, what a remarkable, and I would argue a unique, viewpoint on the relationship that we have with the earth. If we truly understood our eternal relationship with the earth, and the fact, as I think George mentioned earlier, that we're not going to be living, if we're worthy to live in the celestial kingdom, we're not going to another place. We're going to be on this earth, but it's going to be celestialized. If we really understood those doctrines as they are clearly taught and laid out before us, it really would cause us to think twice or three times about how we use Earth's resources and what our obligations are as stewards of the Earth.
Terrific. You know, Rachel, I'll let you jump in here in a second, but while you guys are talking, it reminds me, especially maybe a connection with both you, George, and Craig, the Abrahamic creation story, the Book of Abraham one, is so interesting compared to others in the sense that it really does sort of suggest the aliveness of the created world itself in sort of organizing itself. You know, it's almost like it's a call and response, the God's, you know, call to creation, and they get creation starts moving on its own and shucking and jiving and etc., and the gods look at it and they go, oh, this is good, you know. But it's almost like there's a two-way dialogue of, here, we'd love to have the earth come together in this way, but the very the intelligences or whatever, the aliveness of creation itself is sort of gelling on its own, almost to where you could almost say that this beholdness that you were talking about, George, or the pleasure, you know, that we might have sung with everything was almost like watching this world come forth for us without it being micromanaged from above. Does that make any sense? Do you guys connect at all with that?
Yeah, I think that's nice. Nicely put. It's like a jazz concert. And it's what we understand, at least in our current understanding of science. It seems to be consistent with what we understand about deep evolutionary processes and, you know, life forces moving forward and diversifying. It does seem consistent with that. But it's key, just to add one simple point here. Aldo Leopold, the great conservationist, once said, "We can only be ethical in relationship to something that we feel, perceive, or otherwise have faith in." I think he adds a couple other verbs. Love is one of them. We can't really be ethical in relationship to the earth if we don't perceive it as an object of affection, if we don't perceive it maybe even as a kind of subjectivity worthy of our admiration and caretaking. I mean, if we just see it as a lifeless thing, we don't tend to care for it. We don't think it matters, right? But when we see it as having a kind of sentience or a kind of perceptibility maybe, or a kind of, I mean, again, I keep using this word subjectivity, and I don't really tend to know what it is, but I think it's a vibrancy, it's a life force that's in, or a vitality that's in the earth that I think means we have to be ethical. We have to weigh our choices carefully because we are aware that some choices are going to be better and some are going to be worse for the earth. And that's where the ethics come into play.
Yeah. You know, the term subjectivity, I know what you're saying. It's a little bit weird because people think, oh, it must mean self-consciousness. And I don't really think you have to go with self-consciousness or self-awareness. You know, we have the earth groaning in Moses 7. We have, you know, sort of the Lovelock Lynn Margulies was his partner, the Gaia hypothesis, that, you know, sort of a self-reactionary, you know, organism stuff. But what I did in my dissertation, I was playing with this idea of intrinsic value and sort of intelligence at the base of everything. And I grabbed something from Scott Card's Xenocide, as I don't know if any of you guys know the novel, but the character of the Hive Queen is explaining to the main protagonist, Andrew Wiggin, how they create and bring forth another hive queen, but it talks in terms of them as the creating beings reaching and calling. It's sort of this natural reaching and calling, and then it talks about the substance that sort of answers as hungry and thirsty. So it's hungry for form, it's thirsty for form. There's sort of this sensibility of, you know, a suggestion or a lure, and our hearts and our minds and our reaching goes out, and they're responding sort of in this level of hunger and thirst and desire for pattern and things like that that he talks about. So I really like that. And I think when you get into that whole subjectivity and, you know, intrinsic value and all that stuff, it's so hard to talk about, but I really think there's these really powerful sort of, you know, earthy, you know, these processes that are far below our minds that really can help us kind of feel what's going on there. So, I don't know. Rachel, it's time to get you in here. I want you to jump in on anything we've said or just go us in a new direction with some of your favorite teachings or spiritual touchstones.
Well, I like this idea that we were in some way taking part in creation, and I wonder if we'll also have a part in the restoration of the earth. You know, in the 10th article of faith, it says that the earth will be renewed and receive its protocycle glory, but it doesn't say how that's going to happen. And I just wonder if that's going to be a slow process where we do the work, you know, where we restore this earth from a wasteland of asphalt and weeds and, you know, strip mining into garden again.
Wow.
And if that's the case, you know, our own yard that we have at our house, we've been here for 3 years, and it used to be a parking lot, and we're still pulling out chunks of asphalt and trying to restore this to make it into productive land, to be beautiful and alive again. And it is a slow and backbreaking process to do it.
Wow. Such an interesting concept. That is wonderful. Thank you. What else? I want you to keep going if you can.
Well, I really like the idea that the physical is spiritual for us. You know, as Mormons, we believe in the value of an embodied experience. You know, that's why we're here, after all, to be tried and tested in the physical world. And so not only are our bodies important for that, but the earth is the staging ground where our bodies can act and react. So our physical surroundings are just as important to our salvation as our physical bodies are. And you would think that that would give us a reason to preserve and protect those surroundings for not only our experience, but the experience of future spirit children for when they get their crack at mortality. And, you know, I kind of wonder that if we completely muck up our world so that it's not viable or very pleasant for humanity, how much are we attacking just the plan of salvation itself?
Wow. Bold.
Yeah, I haven't heard that one.
keep going. I mean, I want you to keep jumping in to go harder on that. I was just throwing an amen at you.
But I love the physicality of our experience, that our bodies are how we have sensation and emotion, and how we're able to develop a moral sensibility. The philosophers Hutcheson and Shaftesbury, who influenced Hume, were very interested in this idea that through our experiences of feeling warmth and comfort and love is how we develop our moral responses to know good and evil. And I think that that kind of philosophy goes along very well with our Mormon conception of embodied trial. So that's one particular Mormon thing that I like, that connects with how we view our bodies and how we view the earth.
Very cool, Rachel. Thank you so much for all that. I want to give everybody else a chance to add another favorite teaching or theological resource. Does anybody have one?
Well, I just wanted to add maybe something that dovetails a little bit with what Rachel was saying about restoration. I mean, I don't
want to make claims beyond what is reasonable, but I do think as a theology of restoration that we have an interesting relationship to knowledge. And, you know, Craig was alluding to the fact that we apparently have had extensive knowledge at some point in our existence of the workings of this world. And so maybe it's one of my own favorite ways of thinking about this idiosyncratically, but I like to believe that when I'm learning about the workings of the world, I'm sort of remembering things that I once knew. And I know that's a little bit romantic, and I know science is always changing, but I do think that Mormonism's openness to science and its interest in the workings of the world are very valuable to us on this question, because as Craig was explaining, you know, there's so much information out there, and yet a lot of us do shield ourselves from that information, either out of apathy or fear or distraction, but we don't pay attention to what we can know about everything from the way the climate works to how biology works to why biodiversity matters to air pollution and its effect on public health. I mean, these are all relevant scientific questions, and there's a lot of information available to us, and I think we have doctrinal foundations for investing our efforts in understanding as much as we can about science, and part of me wants to believe that as we do that, we're sort of recovering a knowledge of things that we once knew.
Awesome. I like that. Thank you. That's a fun thing to chew on. All right. We kind of planned out in advance that we'd go to a sort of a practical section at the end. And I know, Rachel, we're gonna call on you a lot in this thing, but let me kind of maybe throw out a couple of ideas that sort of maybe might transition there. One of the things I do like about the plan of salvation is this sort of sense of who we are as eternal beings, divine beings. We were never created ourselves. Whatever gods are, they are gods that work with other things. There's no creation out of nothing, and so it's always cooperation. It's always moving in harmony and persuading things. It sort of seems like the role of the god is to persuade other free agents, you know, in terms of spirits, as well as perhaps at this less self-conscious level, persuading things. And so, I don't know, there's just little neat things like Brigham Young just talking about, you know, one of the things that we're here on this earth to do is to work with creation, and in some ways this is very literally practice for the time when we might create ourselves. It's this idea of honoring the ends and the subjectivity and the desire and the capacities of other things with us. So that's just one of the things that does are. And then of course that, you know, throws us right into the practical things that he talked about. You know, we're going to do a podcast here in a few weeks on the Word of Wisdom and all the deep teachings about it. And it just reminds me of Leonard Arrington's great talk about how the Word of Wisdom, when it was really influenced in Utah, came about because he was trying to say, Brigham Young was saying, well, don't send outside of the region for your coffee, your tobacco, so grow it here. Let's, you know, there's this whole idea of regional self-sufficiency that we had within Mormonism. You know, in other words, we don't want to do it. And so I know a lot of the environmental movement talks about buying local and, you know, locally grown things and not relying on, you know, we don't need to have mangoes year round, you know, so to find, you know, where they're growing somewhere in the world and have them shipped here just so that our, you know, our produce section could be stocked all the time. So I don't know, there's just these ideas about regional self-sufficient economies within our history that I'd love to see us draw on. So maybe that can just be a transition into what are you guys' favorite things. And I'll start with you, Rachel. Where do you start when it comes to just saying, here's the practical things I do and here's the practical stuff that seems to work when I present it to other people to kind of get them excited or started?
Yeah, I love the idea of self-sufficiency and community within Mormon culture. One of my favorite talks is President Kimball's Family Preparedness from 1976, where he was talking about planting your garden, taking care of your yard, and, you know, putting in fruit trees and vines that, you know, have raspberries or blackberries. do everything you can to make your land beautiful and productive. And learn to sew. Learn to take care of your clothes. And I especially like that he said, learn the skills of food storage. So it's not that you go in and buy a ton of wheat, but you actually learn to put up and preserve your own things and to make your own food. Because it's those skills that are going to save you that, you know, or that you'll need to rely on. You know, I have our seed storage, right, where we harvest our seeds from previous years and we plant them again, and we have our compost so we don't have to go and buy fertilizer. And I love this self-sufficiency. And it's not just as individuals or only as families, but within the community. We have a great little neighborhood here. And there was one day where I was with a friend and she was talking about how they need to get rid of these rocks in their backyard. And I said, oh, I would love to have rocks for our flower beds in front. 2 days later, another neighbor dropped them off with his truck. And I love this idea that, you know, it's making both of our yards better. We're working together. And so as a community, we have everything we need here as long as we are willing to do that work with each other. I also like that gives me a physical connection with both of those families and with my property. And I think that really helps in building Zion.
Sweet. We'll circle back to you again. Craig, anything in the practical area that you really think connects well with people?
Well, I'm not sure how well it connects with people, but one of the huge things that we can do as individuals and families in terms of practical consumption of resources is how we decide on where to live. Often those decisions are based on where can we get the least expensive home or the biggest home for the least amount of money. And often that leads us to live in the urban fringe out in distant suburbs. And we, again, this is one of those issues that's been studied to death, but economists have looked at very carefully the economic costs of long commuting, and environmental scientists can calculate with a certain degree of precision the increase in air emissions and air pollution that comes from what we call vehicle miles traveled. And then there are psychologists and sociologists that can look at the societal impact of the vehicle hours traveled, where we commute often in single vehicles all by ourselves. We may commute in many parts of the country, 45 minutes to an hour and a half. And on the East Coast, when we lived in D.C., we had friends at my office that were commuting 2 hours each way. Well, there's an environmental cost to that, but there's also an impact on the family, time spent away from the family because of long commutes. So as we think about what's really important, time with our family, the impact of our commute on the environment, or the ecological footprint, as it's called, we might make choices to live in smaller homes closer to the urban center, closer to where we may be working and shopping, and we may even want to choose to live in areas where there's pedestrian opportunities to walk to school, walk to work, or at least ride our bike. And those who have embraced that lifestyle have found that not only is there an environmental benefit to that, but there's a huge benefit to getting to know your neighbors better and spending more time with your family.
Sweet. Love it. Thank you. Wonderful. George, what you got?
Well, I'll make a comment, and then I want Rachel to tell a story about her primary program for walking.
Okay.
I think simplifying our lives is really at the root of a lot of this. Recently, I did some reflections on a blog about 10 statements by Lowell Bunyan who was a great teacher and a mentor of mine, and he had these very important simple statements like learn to like what doesn't cost much, learn to like reading, conversation and music, learn to like plain cooking, learn to like fields and trees. I won't read all of them, but learn to work, learn to like the song of birds, learn to like gardening. I think if we keep our wants simple and we try to simplify our lives, I think that resonates with people in Mormonism. I think everyone yearns for a simpler time, you know, a little less electronic, technological lifestyle. I think we all, as Craig was saying, would value more time with family, more time with neighbors. And I think a lot of the things that we can do to fight climate change, to lessen our impact on the earth, are things that enhance all of those aspects of a quality of life that we would aspire to. So as we've sort of hinted at in a couple of comments that have been made, we don't have to go right at the politics of environmentalism. We can talk about the principles of a lifestyle that is really calculated to not only lessen our impact on the earth, but increase our human and deepen our human relationships with one another and our sense of place where we live.
Yes.
You know, and I think it just one really simple, fun little thing I tell people is that the word of wisdom, and I know you're going to talk more about that later, but the word of wisdom advocates, we all know, eating meat sparingly, something we don't spend a lot of time talking about. But, you know, there's a lot of information about what kinds of wasteful energy use go into the production of red meat. And other meats. And when we reduce our meat eating by only 20%, it's the equivalent of buying a hybrid vehicle in terms of how much energy and carbon footprint we save. So that's just one simple example of saying, look, if we just lived the gospel with a little more attention and a little more devotion than we do now, I think we would find that what we want in terms of a better environment, we would start to get. So it's not a matter, I mean, this is really the false dichotomy that's, I think, relatively easy to dismiss or clarify for people who might perceive environmentalism as running against the grain of what the church or what the gospel teaches. Because really, in my view, it's simply a matter of getting back to basics. You know, I mean, if you want, we can talk about energy conservation and practical things you can do in your home. And I would just echo what Craig was saying about walkability and being close to work when possible, because I think that makes a big difference.
Very cool. Rachel, let's hear about this primary story.
Oh, well, last year, I did a Walking to Zion challenge with our whole ward, but focusing with the primary children, where each week we would have a different little scripture or song or some reminder about walking and why it was good and things to look for the week. And each week, different people would turn in their little reports for how many miles they walked or rode their bikes, and we had a huge chart in the primary room where we would track our cumulative process as a ward on the trek from Nauvoo to Salt Lake City. And they loved it. The kids really enjoyed doing it. And they would come and talk to me afterwards. And we had one mom who was so glad we were doing it because her girls would go out and ride their bikes around the block over and over and over, building up their miles and come home exhausted and sleep well at night. But it was nice because we live in a ward that is very small geographic area. And so we would see people walking through our neighborhood more. And if we could just get people to walk to our church building, for me, it's 2 blocks from the house. For the people who live the farthest from it, I think it's maybe 6 blocks. If we all walked, then, or everyone who can, because we do have some people in wheelchairs and, you know, with other physical limitations. But then we would be walking to church together. And when we do see other people walking to church, that increases our our Sunday experience. You know, it's a time to be together outside and to relax and enjoy this world that we've been given. I really liked it. The kids loved doing it, and they asked to do it again this year. So we've been doing it. Although this year we did a chart at the beginning, and they're supposed to be keeping track on their own, but they have a hard time remembering to report their mileage this way. But I wanted to try to do it with less paper this year.
Awesome. Oh, I wish I would have known about this last week on the podcast. We talked about Pioneer Day, you know, and different ways to celebrate it. And we did handcart trucks and all that stuff. But among the things we were coming up are, what are some other ways to do it? And so this idea of maybe every spring, you know, looking towards, you know, however many days or 100 days that it took them to cross the plains, typically 100 days of walking and things like that might be another neat way to connect with the pioneer spirit.
Well, they did like it, and we sang the pioneer songs, and we told stories, and we talked about the word of wisdom and you know, plants that they would see. It was great.
Very cool.
Going back to what Craig was saying about where we choose to live, I sometimes forget about this one because we now own our house, but that was a huge factor in even what job my husband chose to take. You know, we chose to come here because this was a town with the university where we could afford to live in walking distance of his work. And so we chose a house in downtown, less than a mile away from campus, so that we can walk to work and school and church and restaurants and the library. And I love it. In Utah, we've got great sidewalks, and we should all be walking more.
Yeah, and you even talk about with your bike, you have a little trailer on there for your groceries and things like that. And so when you shop, you'll throw them in that.
Yeah, it's really fun. And we got a double trailer, even though we have a single child to ride in it, just so that we would have the extra carrying capacity for groceries and things.
Sweet.
Hey,
wonderful.
Hey, Dan, I don't know if this will take us in a different direction. I don't mean to, but you know, one thing that concerns me about I want to celebrate everything and anything that we can do on a practical level as families and individuals, but I think a lot of us feel the weight of how deep and complex the problems are that our society faces, especially climate change that and biodiversity loss, that it seems there are limits to what kind of an impact or difference we can make individually, and that can be overwhelming. And I think for some people it's so overwhelming that it causes despair, or maybe even worse than despair, it causes apathy. And I just want to say one thing about, and I think this is a practical aspect of Mormonism. Mormonism says that we should be active in anxiously engaged in good causes, and that we should be active citizens. And I think one of the most practical and important things we can do is to be involved politically. I really think that's where we can make a big difference, in addition to all the things that we're talking about here. But I think we need to read and inform ourselves and pay attention to what our elected leaders are doing, what kinds of decisions they're making on the city level, on the state level, well, even on the you know, the local neighborhood or school or institution, wherever we work. We have to pay close attention, and of course, on the national level. And I think we should be voices of calling for restraint and calling for careful stewardship. I think it would be a wonderful thing if the day would come when people would say, you know, those Mormons, they really stick up for the earth. They really stick up for principles of stewardship. You hear them talking about it. You don't just see them living it, which, I don't want to diminish any of this as important, but you also see them as voices of concern and taking a leadership in the civic sphere.
Awesome. You know, that reminds me a little bit, one of the lead pieces in the Sunstone issue was by Stephen Peck, who I know is a friend of several of you guys here, and he talks about the Mormons have this tendency sometimes to come late to the game. But when we do come, we're pretty effective. we do it. And so he used the example from the Lord of the Rings trilogy of the trees, or is it the Ents? I'm trying to remind myself of it. Of, you know, Greybeard or whatever. I should have reread it right beforehand. But, you know, we trees, we watch Sauron, you know, tear down the forest and all these things, and we came to it late. But then luckily he says, you know, I got them together, and here we are, and they were able to overthrow the fires, and I can't. I'm not a big Lord of the Rings guy, but I thought it was really terrific. But it's this idea of, if we're discouraged because we seem like we're behind the curve, boy, who knows when that critical mass is going to happen, and we really can be what you say there. Either any of you else with sort of practical things, and again, you guys are just been giving great environmental advice, but is there anything else in Mormonism that you love that really pushes you in a practical direction? A lot of times with these podcasts, I'm really looking for my audience that's saying, I really want to break into Sunday school discussion, or I want to be able to speak up, and so I love it when we can sort of give practical advice on something that clearly is gospel and find our way into discussions.
I think we have to be careful not to make this a political conversation. And unfortunately, what some of us might perceive as non-political might still be perceived as political by somebody else. And in church settings, you know, I always feel like, you know, I've got to strike that balance between being honest and expressing my views openly and honestly, and also respecting differences of opinion and the ways in which my opinions might not sit well with other people in a way that, you know, I need to be aware of. Maybe I need to phrase things more carefully or whatever. So I do think it's, you know, I try to walk this very carefully, because I don't want this to be a political issue. I think it is political is the problem, and it's politicized. I was just saying, get involved in the politics of it, because I think it's necessary to make that translation and make that leap. But as soon as we make that leap, of course, we're going to find we disagree with others, even others who share the same principles. You know, I have friends who share the overall ambitions that I do with regard to having better stewardship, but we don't always agree on, you know, what the right policies might be.
Excellent.
I just wanted to preface that. I would say we have to be careful about how we bring it up in church, because I don't think it should be an agenda type thing,
right,
that we're driving.
Right.
And that this is all about sort of getting somebody to make the right vote. But I do think any time we talk about the creation, I'm always amazed at how quickly we gloss over that story. And I think that's at least one thing where we ought to just really slow down and say, now wait, I've done this in Sunday school lessons several times now, where I've said, let's make a list of all the unique features of the restored account of the creation. Let's include what we know from the Book of Abraham, Book of Moses, from the temple ceremony, and then build from there. And, you know, when they see the fullness of what it is we have, And then they're asked, so what do you think this means? What responsibilities does this knowledge place on us? People start figuring it out pretty easily. So I think staying doctrinally focused on the story of the creation, I would throw in DNC 104, DNC 59, DNC 49. Am I missing any? Craig is quite the scriptorian on all these things, but those are some of the fundamental scriptures that I think are just so vital to be constantly reminded of.
Well, section 93 has the spirit and the body, as well as independent in each sphere in which God has placed it to act for itself, and sort of this, you sort of get this sense of each bit of creation having its own end.
And DNC 80. Yeah, the light of Christ and the light of the moon and the stars.
The interconnectedness of all of it that kind of is tied there. Yeah, there's really a neat spirituality in that. Well, great. I appreciate that, and I really do think your caution about making sure that we don't sound too political is really terrific.
I mean, I think we can be political all we want in the civic sphere. I don't say, you know, but, you know, church hallways are a little different.
Cool. Craig or Rachel, if you were to, you know, kind of close with something you haven't said before that you just want to get said, whether it's in the area of practical stuff or is there just another piece of Mormonism that comes up to you to give a shout out to?
Well, I guess as now a parent and grandparent, I am increasingly feeling like where these concepts can and should be taught and can be taught the best and in terms of environmental stewardship practices as well as our theology is right in our home. I agree with George that there's some risk that because issues pertaining to the environment have become so politicized, there's a risk when those things may be discussed from the pulpit or in the Sunday school class or priesthood or leaf society that hard feelings can develop, and especially during this current political climate. But I think there's just no end to the family home evenings, to the family vacations that can be focused on enjoying God's creations and studying earth science and the way ecosystems work. If we could all just remember as families our responsibility as parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles to instill a reverence for life and a love for the earth, as George eloquently pointed out previously, that's where our ethical behavior begins, when we can feel that great affection for God's creations, and there's no better place to do that than in the family. And now more than ever, do we need to have that time spent focused, enjoying nature, because as we all know, and as some have written about, our children are experiencing a nature deficit syndrome. They're not getting outside. They're not riding their bikes and walking around the neighborhood like they used to. And but for Boy Scouts, some of our young men would probably never get out and experience backpacking. So we really could do a lot as families in that regard.
Wonderful. Thank you. Rachel, what would you jump in with?
I would say that, you know, as a general authority, I can't push this on the church. I can't force us all to care about stewardship and environmentalism. But as just a lowly member of the church, you know, just a member of my family and my congregation, I can testify, you know, that I found it empowering to have skills of self-sufficiency, to have this knowledge. And I can share just this love of the created world that I have, you know, the wonder and awe that I see looking at, you know, the little plants in my garden, and the reverence that I feel before the majesty of all of the wilderness, and, you know, all of these things that are beyond my ability to create or to make, but they're here for me to appreciate and to, through my appreciation of them, to know God and to feel that respect and love for Him through His creation. And I think that that kind of testimony, that honest love and wonder of the world, is what I can give to my fellow saints, to encourage them in small ways to rediscover that love and to show that through their actions.
Love it. Thank you so much. That is powerful. Well, you guys, should we end there? Feel like you've said everything you wanted to say, or at least pointed in the right direction?
Good. Hey, can I tell you a quick funny thing?
Yeah.
On our Word of Wisdom lesson in sharing time, I had one of my neighbors bring in a live chicken for the children. How funny is that?
Very cool.
You know, I brought in tons of herbs from the garden and vegetables and grains, and we talked about all these good things for us, and then my friend brought in his chicken, and I'm like, now look, this bird has a personality. Do you really want to be eating these all the time? Whenever we eat this bird, we should be very thankful for it and, you know, be prudent in our use. Hey, the kids thought it was great, and they all got to pet the bird.
Very cool. Very cool. That reminds me, actually, I think it was Gary Snyder His poet wrote Turtle Island and things like that, but he talks about instead of an enmity with nature, we should have an intimacy, and that we really should be aware of, you know, where our food comes from, and truly, if our meals involve the sharing another form of life, especially one with a personality and things like that, that we should be very aware of, that we should truly be grateful, you know, for that sharing of their life for ours. You know, all life is robbery. All life requires the taking of other life, and we should own up to that.
Yep. The whole lesson was Thanksgiving and prudence, and they liked it. The rooster was very good and did not poop and chirp.
Thank you, you guys, so much. You know, what I loved about having all of you on is you're just positive and constructive and all the things that you think about with Mormonism. You know, we're all aware that there's places to go and things that we're maybe lagging behind on, or things that can sort of complicate our church lives and things like that. And you're not being discouraged by it. You're just jumping in with your personal witness. You're jumping with your scholarship. You're jumping in and influencing for the best. And to me, that's what this whole podcast is about, is, you know, people and voices that can model things that will make a difference as we go forward. So thank you for spending an hour and a half with us this night.
Thanks so much, Dan. It was fun.
Thanks, Dan. Good job.
Well, I loved it. Please, everybody, come to the blog and share your own experiences with, you know, things that work in your life as you testify and as you live green, or the stumbling blocks that you want to get some advice on, or things like that. So let's have an active conversation on the blog afterwards. Feel free to always donate to the podcast when you're there. Again, thank you, George. Thank you, Craig. Thank you, Rachel. You guys have been just wonderful, and we're glad to have your voices out in front of the Mormon Matters audience. So we'll wish you all good night.
Good night.
Thanks. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.